here we go.
Okay, so this is the week in Further Web Science where we are looking at digital inequality. And this is a long-standing topic within web science, and it's always been a central element in Further Web Science, often something that is part of the assessment for the end of this module. So Les, do you want to say something about if and how you see this as part of the assessment now, or do you want to leave it to the end?
Well, I think that when we're considering policy implications, then they often come from kind of quite extreme positions about technology, and they can often be very, wow, this technology is going to solve everything for us. We have to, this is the way we'll do everything. And we've seen that in a number of situations. Or they come from the fact that, oh, this policy, this technology will destroy everything that we have and we must never use it. And so I think, it's fair to say we see a lot of techno-optimism about AI, whatever AI is. And so this is a useful perspective to understand, make sure that we, this aspect of the relationship to technology to society, of the digital to society and our culture is really important.
I think that's really helpful. So often what we see is that we have new waves of new technologies which appear to be neutral and appear to be a fix, some kind of techno fix for everything. And there's a backward-looking tendency which says, well, we didn't get things right in the past, but this time it's going to be fixed, this time the technology is right, this time we're going to do it in the right way. And technologies are often presented as abstracted from social relations and social inequalities. And as web scientists, we know already that technologies can never be abstracted from the world that produces them and the world in which they operate. And so too the question of inequality, because we live in a deeply divided and unequal world. So when we look back to the origins of the web, we can see that there was a lot of optimism about the web and how the web was going to be liberating and egalitarian and give voices to people that didn't have voices before, that it was going to, some discourses around information wants to be free, and people who've never had access to the power of information before will finally have access to this power, that relatively low barriers of entry to the web, relatively low, both as a consumer initially and subsequently as a producer when we think about Web 2.0. So there was a lot of optimism around the web. And if you think about some of the arguments that are still made by people like Tim Berners-Lee, there still is a frustration on their part that something that he feels is intrinsically an egalitarian and liberating system of information sharing has somewhere gone wrong. And so when you read his recent writings, and particularly the discussion, although he's dropped this a little bit now, about the pro-human web, the sense is that the web was meant to be like this, and something's gone wrong, something's got in the way. And from a web science perspective, of course, we can see that the real world, the social world, the economic, the political world, has shaped and continues to shape the web. So what I wanted to do in this lecture was to talk through some of those phases of thinking about inequality in the web and how the web that was envisaged as this very liberating for everybody, the web is for everyone, has turned out not quite to be for everyone in anything beneath a very surface level. In fact, not even a surface level, really. And there's three phases that I want to talk about. I'm wittering on a bit now. One is in terms of equality of access, an inequality of access, which was very much a kind of hardware phase. The second phase was inequalities in terms of value derived, if you like. So who can get the greatest value out of the web, and how is that shaped? And then the third is in terms of content and I suppose third and fourth, I thought a little bit about this. One is about content, you know, what, who controls what the web is and what's on the web, who it's for, what we get to see. So there's questions there. And of course, as we move on from that, is the question of data and data inequalities, or inequalities in the ways in which data are harvested and used and reused, and how they may shape social, economic and political inequalities in the world. So there's those phases in terms of debate. So I just wanted to run through those, really. I think the first one is probably less interesting, although less interesting because in a way some of the debates moved past it. In that very first phase of thinking about inequality, it was who has access to the web, who in the world has access to the web. And there was a lot of concern in the 90s and the early 2000s about inequalities simply in terms of access to the web. And that's important because I think it has faded over time. It hasn't faded quite as much as you might imagine. This is the first year of doing this lecture that I haven't said, remember, more than half the world's population still does not have access to the web. Okay? Sometime in 2017, we flipped from under 50% of the world having access to the web to over 50% of the world having access to the web. So that's a really significant point, but it remains the fact that almost half the world's population does not have access to the web. Significant numbers of those people don't even know what the web is. And it's really important to remember that. If I ever read another essay which says, we now, our lives are shaped by the web, everybody now, you know, uses the web for everything. No, they don't. You know, it's such a kind of ethnocentric, Eurocentric perspective to think in that way. And so what this diagram shows, obviously, is how that's unequal across different parts of the world, with the lowest proportions of access in Africa and Asia, and then obviously in North America and Europe, some very high levels of access. Yes, can you change the next slide? So the point about access was that access was seen as a form of social exclusion. And still, we could argue, I think, it is a form of exclusion, social exclusion. As the world becomes more and more web-centric, as more and more we powerful interests use, rely, communicate through the web, to not be part of that, to be excluded from that, is a form of social exclusion. And that's a form of social exclusion both within countries, between countries that we were just talking about, but also within countries. Les, can you do the next one? So in terms of between countries, I always find it difficult to explain this diagram. I don't know if you've seen this before. So this is a map of the numbers. So the countries are represented in terms of the numbers of people in those countries, that it's scaled. Mm-hmm. The sizes of the countries represent the actual number, the total number of people in each of those countries that is using the web. The colour, the lighter, from white to the darker orange, represents the proportion of people in those countries who are already using the web. So if you'd looked at this 10 years ago, you would have had a much bigger North America. What you can see here now is countries like China and India, which are starting to look really very big in comparison with North America, and yet still only have, in India, between 0 and 20% of the population using the web. In China, it's between 40 and 60%. So if you imagine that as the trajectory that we're on, you're going to see some really, really big changes in terms of who the major users of the web are over time.
Canada's not even featured on there.
Canada?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Canada.
That might be Canada there.
It's like a crinkle cut palette.
Yeah, Canada does seem to have fallen off, doesn't it? South Korea is interesting.
Yeah.
But these are done by the Oxford Internet Institute. They may have a more up-to-date version. I just think that's very salutary in some ways. I think it's quite powerful. Not only because it shows inequality, but it also tells you something about the future, I think. So, also within countries, Les, can you do the next one? So, these are old-ish, 6-7 years old, some of them, but you can see some really, really radical differences in internet use between different parts of, in this case, the UK and Australia. So people tend to think of not having access to the internet as being something that's all about Africa and India and countries outside Western Europe. Actually, if you look at the UK, there's something like 1 in 10 of all UK citizens have never used the web. Okay, that's 6 plus million people in the UK, if you've never used the word. There's some figures on the US as well, which show... It's very weird not controlling my slides. Okay, let's have the next slide. I'm not going to look at my notes anymore. Okay, so the initial attempts in terms of policy to address this was through trying to allow people access to the internet. And the thinking really was that if only people had access to the internet, then everything would be okay. It was simply the access barrier that was the problem. So we saw a lot of policy attempts to do something about that, both in within countries and between countries. So we saw things like one laptop per child, you know, the initiative to try and give children laptops in the third world. And we saw things like community technology centres and libraries and all kinds of community initiatives. If only people had the access, then the exclusion would be dealt with. It would no longer be a problem. What all the data showed was that this was not simply an accidental matter, who did or didn't have access. This was partly a question of between countries and partly a question of poverty and development and so on. But even within Western countries, there are some really, really strong patterns in terms of class, age, race, education and so on. So if we looked in 1999, for example, I'm not sure if that's on the next slide, I don't think. This is from 1999 from the US. You can just see this data in terms of how the poorest families were vastly less likely to have access to the internet. It was heavily racialised and shaped by income, by demographics of one sort or another. Can you do the next one, Liz? Les, can you do the next one, please? And bringing that a bit more up to date, so that was 1999, and people might sometimes look at those figures from 1999 and say, oh, well, you know, that was in prehistory, it's not like that anymore. If we look in the US in 2014, 25% of the population still did not use the internet. One in four people in 2014 in the US did not use the internet. I mean, that's really not what people expect. In 2017, as I just said, one in ten in the UK have never used the internet. And again, those differences in terms of access are not evenly spread. So it's not a random one in ten or a random 25%. This is heavily weighted in terms of age, in terms of social class, and in terms of whether there are children in the household, which is an interesting, and it's obviously linked to age, there's an interesting additional fact. So Les, if you could do the next one, please. So this is figures from ONS, last year's figures from ONS, and it shows the age. This is the age trajectory here. So you see that people over 75 are much less likely to have access on a regular basis, and it goes up 16 to 34, you see almost 99% of people have access to the internet in the last year, I think, in the last 3 months, it is. And then here you see that pattern by SEC, by socioeconomic class. These are, I'm sure you're familiar with these are managerial and professional owner classes. These are right down to the unskilled social classes. And there's a significant gap in terms, and this is from 2008, so this is probably a bit different now. But still, I would guess we're going to find some differences there. So the point is that access both between and within countries is linked to questions of social inequality. Can I have the next slide then? So, in short, access continues to be a problem, but even if people are given access, they don't necessarily use it. And Ofcom, so it's not necessarily a case that everybody's saying, please give us the web, if only we had the web, we'd use it. There are people who just don't want to use it. Okay? Pardon?
Paul Merton, and have a news for
Paul
you.
Paul Merton, does
yeah,
he say that?
He's very proud that he doesn't have email, doesn't have a computer, doesn't have a mobile phone.
Interesting. He is what Ofcom would call a core resistor.
Yeah.
And I'm going to come back to that later, but I think there is this idea that everybody should want to use the web, but this is a normal thing to do, and that if you don't, in some way you're a bit perverse.
Yeah, yeah.
You are resisting something. And what we find quite often is that a common response to that is to say, well, it's just the older generation. It's the rump. I've heard people talk about the rump. And once the rump dies, everybody will be using the web, and that will be fine. rather than looking at the conditions under which people do and don't use the web, which is something I want to say a bit about in a minute. So let's move on. Okay, this is what I just said. The access model assumes that all internet use is a general good and that it's in everybody's interest to want to use the web. Core resistors assumes that non-use is perverse. And this is a very, very normative position which imagines that somehow users are undifferentiated, the web is a universal good, and all you've got to do is give these undifferentiated users access to this normative good and everything will be fine.
Or even that the web is a single thing, presumably.
Well, we're going to come on to that.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. An alternative way of looking at this would be to start not with the technology as a normative good, but would be to start with people and to start with what is in people's interests and how people conceptualise the web and the position that the web has in their own everyday lives. And a really good book that I recommend you look at is by Melissa Gilbert and I can't remember her first name. What is her name? Masucci. Can't remember. Where they are called strategists for bridging the digital divide. Can you do the next slide? Which is this book, Michelle. I knew it began with a name. So these are two social geographers who are based at Temple University in Philadelphia. Temple University is a community university which sits just on the central north part of Philadelphia, right bridging some of the areas of the biggest housing projects and the poorest and most socially excluded populations in the US. And Melissa and Michelle, being at Temple, they have a kind of outreach ethos, which is that the university should do social good, that it should do good in its local community. And what they did was to set up a number of interventions in the late 2000s, and they're still going strong actually, designed to support people in those very poor communities to get online, to acquire the skills in order to be able to use, not only have physical access, but also the soft skills, the educational skills, in order to be able to use the web. And it's a very interesting story. It makes very interesting reading. What they began with in this book was, what they began with was that access alone wasn't enough. That if they just gave people a community technology centre and stuck some computers, I mean, this is pre-mobile web, right? So they just gave people some computer terminals in a community technology centre and said, there you go, people, you know, you're equal now, you've got access to the web. It possibly wasn't going to be quite that simple. And they knew that they needed to work to develop the skills that would be required in order to derive some kind of benefit from the web. And in some cases, that was simple skills like using a mouse or using a keyboard or literacy. People forget that there are significant and important numbers of people in places like Philadelphia who do not have basic literacy skills to be able to use the web. It's no use to you if you can't read. It's no use to you if you can't write or type. Or you don't understand what a search engine is. All of these things were quite basic skills. And this was building on the work by someone called Esther Hargasay, who actually saw these differences in skills as a further source of inequality. So for some people, they can derive Mark Zuckerberg, and some of it's luck, of course, but they have Harvard, and he was, you know, he had the basic skills in order to be able to derive huge benefit out of, maybe he doesn't think that now, but out of the web. Whereas other people, actually, a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing, and the web can be quite a dangerous place. And you think about identity theft, or you think about fraud of one sort or another. So actually, just the idea that all you need is access and then people are going to be equal users is clearly not true, and that the quality of use also depends on the value that you are able to derive for yourself out of your use of the web. So, Michelle and Melissa began from that perspective, that it had to be about skills as well. It couldn't just be about providing the hardware. And they did a whole series of projects, and I haven't got time to talk about all of them. The most interesting one, I think, is the Community Technology Centre, which was at Harrison Plaza. So they got the funding, they set up this Community Technology Centre, they staffed it with students, PhD students, from Temple University, and their idea was, these were largely black families, largely female-headed families, young families with children, And their thinking was that they would help to educate these women in order to learn how to use the web, which would improve their life chances and ultimately enable them to earn more money. The context for this, well, no, let me come back to the context. What they found was not at all what they expected. So they set up a community technology centre and no women came. The people that did come were the women's children. The children came and the children spent time after school in the community technology centre, but they found it really difficult to get the adults to come. This was against all the expectations, because the expectations were that this was a socially exclusive group. They would jump at the opportunity to have access both to the hard and the soft skills that were required. Why were they not coming? You know, what was wrong with them? What was perverse about them? These were not old people. They weren't even the rump. You know, these were young women. The explanation that they make in this book is that we have to look at the rationality of those people's lives, and the context for those people's lives was radical reform in the welfare system at the time, such that in the US, at that time, a new law was introduced. I don't know if it was in the US or it was at state level, but certainly affected these women. But over your whole life course, you were only allowed to claim a total of 5 years' state benefits. Okay? So for young women who were working, the absolute imperative was to stay in work, probably to have two or three different jobs, because many of these were part-time, low-paid, insecure jobs. And on top of that, the idea that you would then go and give up some of your time working to learn how to use a computer for no real clear benefit, no job at the end of it, simply didn't make sense. What they really needed in order to hold together their jobs was decent childcare. So what did they tell the kids to do after school? They sent them along to the community technology centre, where these lovely PhD students would spend their time doing childcare. Because from the point of view of those families, it's what made sense. It's completely what made sense to them. So their argument, you know, is not, I think it's an interesting story, but their argument is not that that's going to be the same in any other case. Their point is, if you want to understand if and how people are going to be encouraged to use the web, and whether that's even a good thing that makes sense for them in their lives, you need to understand what people's lives are like.
I think, Dermot, that's what you were saying before, when you were talking about the basic laggards, the late adopters, what they called again?
What was it called? The core resistors.
The core resistors. There seems to be, some in kind of the language of that, it almost sets a premise that these are irrational people. Mm. Why wouldn't you want access to the network? Where
exactly.
Actually you're dealing with entirely rational people.
Exactly.
And it's your job as a policymaker to understand what their rational decision is.
Exactly. And because it's a normative, it positions a normative, well-educated,
yeah,
employable, individual, and I mean individual, not taking into account family relationships or responsibilities or the materialities of everyday life. Yeah. It's a kind of cerebral individual who wants to learn stuff for the sake of learning stuff, because the web's a good thing. And so when I see people say, oh, well, we'll give them people in Africa the web because that will deal with the problem of, you know, whatever, underproduction of food or drought, or you think, please, you know, this is just insulting, actually. So, I mean, there was another case here, which is not in their book, which was the... I haven't even put it on here. I only know this because they told me.
Mm.
They didn't put it in the book because it was libelous. But where all the computers were stolen, and people stole them and sold them to pay their rent. And it's a bit like saying, if you put something that looks quite a lot like a big pile of money in front of people who've got no money and are about to be evicted and have no food, what makes sense?
Mm.
Does it make sense to spend 3 months learning how to do an Excel spreadsheet or whatever it was, or maximise your search engine use?
It's time inconsistency in poverty. You can't, when you're impoverished, it's very difficult to look beyond next week when you have to survive at the moment. If you're given something that's short, you can only be short term. Mm-hmm. So the idea of investing into your long term.
And they didn't.
Quality doesn't work.
You know, the way they write the book is really careful. It's probably much more careful than I've said it. They're very, very careful and very respectful of the lives of the people that they're talking about. They're not seeing that they're perverse. And the reason they didn't put the story about the theft in was also they didn't want to make it seem like these were feckless or criminals or people who it would be very easy to dismiss as not making sensible choices. But you know, we all know from criminology about the rationalities of the choices that people make in terms of crime and the way that those choices are made. So they're very specific stories from Philadelphia. They're very dramatic stories because of the nature of the lines. But the broader point is not necessarily about those people or even about those very dramatic stories. The broader point is that if we want to understand the place that the web has in people's lives, we can't start from a presumption that the web is a good thing for everyone. We need to start by understanding the lives that people are leading and if and where new forms of technology do or don't help people in those lives, where they fit and don't fit. So we have to get away from the core resistance narrative towards something that recognises the rationalities of everyday life. Okay, I don't think I explained that very well. So, that's what I just said. The implications beyond North Philadelphia in the late 2000s, which seems like a very specific case, but is an instructive and illustrative case study for thinking about inequality in relation to the web. Right. Okay, this was the third category.
Can I just ask, are you aware of research that looks at, say, not different demographics, but say, across certain age groups? So what I'm having, what I'm thinking of is, how this problem is even exacerbated and gets bigger and bigger by discourses in society about what's happening and rights and wrongs have arguably shifted from the arena where these things are played out. It's no longer the television set, which can be used by pretty much everybody, you just have to switch it on. It now happens online, and the discourses there shape larger social political affairs. So you have a large group of people who are excluded on technological grounds or resist, but then this exclusion is kind of getting worse on some sort of discursive level, because they're no longer part in the sort of discourses that people have in society. About what's, the whole Facebook thing, for instance, that's in the news, and that basically has no bearing on the lives of these people. So I wonder how that is an interaction on the level of technology and what society is all about.
So I think that's part of the process, that the way in which social exclusion works. And so just because if you don't use the web, it's not only that you don't have access to all the supposedly good advantages of being able to buy cheaper fridges or vote online or whatever it is. It's also that you're culturally
Yeah, exactly.
The language is, and I don't know if that's just older people. I mean, it could apply to anybody who's just not part of that world. So as sort of what I was saying earlier, as we live in a more and more web-centric world, to not be part of that is more and more exclusive.
Yeah.
And as the web moves on, presumably the problem evolves from simply, do you have access to the web? Because the smartphone kind of changed the balance a bit for many people. To do you have a stable social... cultural identity as a citizen on the web.
So
have you got some? Mm-hmm. Can you apply for jobs?
Yeah.
Have you got an address or a digital address, a physical address that people can access? You can access goods and services.
You're a non-person if you're not.
Yes,
online.
You may have access to the web, but you're just you're kind of a homeless person on the web, as it were.
And as I think you make a really good point about as the web changes, and that's why I think this argument about the elderly rump is a really misconceived argument. Because yes, there might be an elderly rump that's going to disappear if you think the web's never going to change. But if you think the web is, because all that happens is, people then, they go to school, they learn how to use it, it stays the same for the whole of their lives, and then they're not the elderly rump. Okay, because they know how to use the web.
Mm-hmm.
We all know the web is going to continue changing and evolving. We all know, we're in a very privileged and unusual position, but we all know there's things that we don't know about the web. And as the web evolves and changes, there's always going to be bits of it that people are excluded from. Now, whether that's going to be patterned by age, maybe. Maybe we're all going to lose the inclination to keep up with it as we get older. Maybe we just can't be bothered, but the idea that thinking about those people in North Philadelphia, and the point that you made earlier, that's about the web isn't one thing, it's many, there's always going to be, well, for most people, bits of the web that they know nothing about and they're not interested in learning about. So this idea that you're either on it or you're off it is crazy. And actually what we need to be thinking about is the really facile thing is where it's one thing to watch kittens on skateboards, it's another thing to make millions of pounds in Bitcoin trading. Mm. Now, these are different kinds of assets that people with different social positions, well, people with different social assets, are able to derive or not derive from the web.
And I suppose the genuine worry is that some people are disenfranchised. If you think that argument through, you just said earlier, okay, no, it's an overstatement to say everyone is on the web and et cetera, et cetera. But if you really make the claim that, say, Facebook and Cambridge Analytica brought about Donald Trump, arguably has an effect on pretty much everybody regardless of whether or not they have access to the web.
Absolutely.
So there's some real exclusion on that.
Absolutely, and decisions.
Very serious level.
Absolutely, and decisions are being made about global trade in raw materials or where to drop bombs, or I don't know, that's maybe not very webby, but I mean, the web is being used to circulate information and make profound decisions that affect the lives of many people, even if they have no idea what the web is.
Exactly.
It's still impacting on lives. So I think. And this is where we move on to this kind of stuff. I mean, this started with thinking about, you know, what's on the web and who's it for. So if you don't... It was once the case that if you don't speak English, there wasn't very much content for you online. Of course, now if you speak Chinese, there's probably even more content for you online. Also questions, of course, of ownership, control, surveillance, and the content. Now, when I first started doing this lecture, probably, 10 years ago, nobody's heard of the filter bubble. I'd say, how many of you have heard of the filter bubble? And people would say, oh, I don't know, what's that? And I used to play the Eli Paris TED Talk, if you've seen it, I don't know, it's good. And now everyone's like, oh, filter bubble, that's just so... And that's just happened, I would say, in the last 2 or 3 years. That's now something that people are very, very aware of, that some actors have huge agency in shaping who sees what and when and why online. And this idea that somehow the web is this freedom of information and that everyone has access to the same sources of information, that it's a radical flattener in terms of who can see what, has been totally blown out of the water with the knowledge that what we see is being profoundly shaped. What we see is being profoundly shaped, and also how we are seen is profoundly shaped through surveillance and data. The uses of data in one way or another. This was just about language, but I don't think we need to talk about that. And this is where we get into the stuff that you're both really interested in, I think, which is more the stuff about how algorithmic decision making is being used in ways that discriminate against certain social groups. So you're probably aware of both of these stories, which is where the first one, where women are shown ads for high-paid jobs. Women are much less likely to be shown ads for high-paid jobs. And the other one is where companies are using Facebook to exclude older workers from job ads. So I think the first one, from memory, is a result of learning, machine learning, from data which says that women are less likely to be paid as well as men. And therefore it makes more sense to show women the lower-paid jobs, because women are there, understood as lower-paid beings, so you would show them the lower-paid jobs. That's a kind of rational outcome from learning from that data. I think the second one is where companies are actually paying Facebook to only show their adverts to certain age groups, which is actually illegal, so I don't quite know how they're getting away with it. So it's basically using data, using data in different ways to differentiate in terms of the opportunities that are given to different social groups, largely social groups that are already unequal in one way or another. So it's exacerbating, it's building on top of and it's produced by and reproducing the social inequalities that already exist. Can we go to the next one then? Okay, we can't see these very well. These are from Farinak's PhD, if you know. Have you met Farinak? Farinak Hardcastle, she's in the fourth year of her PhD. And she's interested in online behavioural tracking and advertising, and how online behavioural tracking is used to build up profiles about individuals and then to discriminate or differentiate, depending on your language, in the information that is served to individuals. So some of the more famous examples are around price fixing on things like insurance or on the prices that people are offered for goods and services, depending on what those companies think they know about those people. And allegedly, most companies are not using direct discrimination, so they're not saying, oh, we know this is a black person, therefore we're not going to offer them this service, but they are using all kinds of indirect discrimination around surnames, around postcodes, in order to identify groups who they think are more risky, or groups that they think they can screw more money at, one way or another, basically. Endless examples of that, and some really good books, or at least some really good looking books that have been produced recently. I say good looking because I haven't read them yet, but a whole load of books. There's Automating Inequality here, about how algorithmic decision making is used in decisions about bail, about probation, and of course, one of the biggest problems is that we don't know how these algorithms are operating. These are not in the public realm. There's all kinds of people trying to do reverse engineering of one sort or another. So we should do some more of this. Tressie McMillan Cotton has had her students applying to job agencies with different surnames, and she's been kind of doing all sorts of crowdsourced stuff just to see what happens, to try and reverse engineer, to produce some outcomes from the algorithms that are being used to see if and how they're producing discriminating results. This isn't really Cathy O'Neill. I mean, Cathy O'Neill is more about how inappropriate methodologies are used with big data. I have read her
book. Yeah, she's going into, certainly from a book and a TED talk, she goes a lot more into the actual algorithm itself. So she's really kind of deconstructing the different components of the algorithm. But she talks about prison bail, she talks about that kind of inequality, she talks about the bias in job applications.
Mm.
What I find particularly interesting is about, I find one particularly interesting about hotspot policing. So effectively you get people say there's a high correlation between poverty and crime. Of course, because of hotspot policing, the Eye of Saruman is only ever looking at street corners that are impoverished.
Mm-hmm.
So the high correlation, you're not actually measuring the high correlation between poverty and crime, you're measuring the effectiveness of that feedback loop between impoverished areas and police interest. Whereas if you just switch the Eye of Saruman, for example, to Canary Wharf, you'd start getting hits there and create a new feedback loop. It's all about this kind of feedback loops.
Mm-hmm.
I found really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not new. It may be being mediated through new forms of data or new digital. It may be much faster because of communication.
I think it's just more apparent.
I suppose for a judge, what is qualitatively new is that the process by which you arrive at that decision is now a black box. Cannot be a judge or a probation officer.
Yeah.
You're unable to discuss how you got to that recommendation.
So I guess that's outsourced to private sector that sells this as a business.
If you talk to some computer scientists, talk to Pete Burnett, for example, at Cardiff, I've had this conversation about algorithmic accountability. Well, we were talking about neural nets. Do you remember that conversation? And I have asked three computer scientists to explain neural nets to me, and all three of them independently have said, it's magic.
Yeah.
You, Mark, and Pete Burnett all said the same thing to me. So that speaks to your point that we don't know how this process is.
It definitely falls into that category of computer science that is indistinguishable from magic, because even to try and explain it is just too difficult. You know, you might and too obscure, and you might as well just say it's magic. You know, even if you do know, even if you do have an idea, right? And there are things that are emerging about the principles of, you know, neural nets, but it's still just, you know, sort of so much removed from what we have experienced.
But if we step away from neural nets for a minute, and as I understand it, think about most algorithmic decision making, which is actually much more simplistic than that, then, you know, people like Pete and Stefan Starr, they'll say, the potential is to make algorithmic decision making more accountable than human decision making, because actually in the more simplistic methods of machine learning and algorithms are making first, and then onto that machine learning, you can actually retrace every single step that's been made. So this idea of explainable AI, that you could track every single decision-making point and tell people more about why they were refused car insurance or why their house insurance went up, if the companies were so minded to make it transparent, that could be an even more accountable rather than less accountable. So it's what's getting in the way is not the technology. No. What's getting in the way is the interests that own the technology and are using it for their own ends.
So as a computer scientist, or as a nerd, you know, I find all these arguments about the black boxing of the algorithm. I just think this is ridiculous. Exactly in what way are current decision-making processes with people and institutions not a black box?
Well, you know, I guess the difference
not
is
unaccountable. Yeah,
I was thinking of in terms of the people involved in the process, say a probation officer and a judge that decide on the defendant's period of probation. It's one thing to have a chat amongst yourself and look at the file and come to a decision, or to give that all to some company that then comes back and says the algorithm recommends X, Y, and Z. So it's a black box for the people who make a decision.
See, I find both of those equally scary.
At least, I guess, there's the vain hope that you can talk about these things
in
a way. Well, you know,
Sorry, I'm being deliberately disruptive.
Another way of looking at it is that with algorithmic decision making, there is actually a trace of how the decision's been made. With human decision making, if it's made on the golf course or behind closed doors, there is no trace of how the decision was made other than in the minds of the people who were there.
Quite contrary to the web being that universal thing, and particularly on that point, what's interesting is some people enjoy a highly personalised service when it comes to banking, or if you're wealthy enough, you don't speak to a computer, you speak to a personal assistant, a genuine person, right? So the decisions about job applications or a loan being automated, they are for different for a certain group of people. You know, so there's also a sort of bias in everybody. You get basically get your way out of it.
The algorithm, if you example, just beyond criticism, so it comes back a risk factor 80%, so you're 80% at risk of defaulting on a debt. So you've been denied credit or whatever, you've been denied something because the computer says 80%, but there's no way of knowing what variables are used. Well, to the common person, there's no way of knowing what goes on in the black box, or what variables are used, how they were calculated, what the statistical methods were used, what kind of assumptions are in the framework of the... There's no way that... But at least when you're talking to a person, you can at least, to some degree,
There is a way of knowing...
If you open up the guts of the algorithm.
So it's not the technology that's at fault.
No, absolutely. It's not the technology that's fault. It's you pull this stuff in the black box. Mm-hmm. You don't know what variables, unless you code the program in a certain way, that's on your dashboard, for example, you've got a whole load of variables, so you're an 80% risk factor. Unless you have got all of the variables, then to some degree you do have to understand some statistical methods that are used in the production of that number within the algorithm. So there must be some kind of human knowledge in there, which comes back to the skills right from the top end. So there's a whole... Because until you do that, you're putting the algorithm beyond question, and you're saying this figure is unquestionable. And it's not unquestionable because the algorithm's wrong, it's because you don't have the ability to question the judgment it has produced, or the decision that it's produced, or recommendation.
You don't have the ability, and also the organisation that is making decisions that way does not have the interest to tell you.
Because that takes time, it takes skills, it takes training,
it takes inclination.
There's no incentive to do so.
At the moment, so it feels at the moment, for me personally, I don't think all of this is inevitable.
Oh no, certainly not.
It feels like we're in the Wild West at the moment. And when we talk to...
Been here before.
Yeah, we have been here before. Yeah. When no companies, or very few companies, want to open up their algorithmic decision-making to any kind of interrogation, because I think it feels like they are terrified of what's going on in there. Yeah. The one exception to that in the project that we were trying to put together, was Schufa in Germany, which is the equivalent of
Experian.
Or it's a credit rating agency, basically. It's owned by the German or regulated, very heavily regulated. And there was they really wanted to show to the public that they were credible and that they were fair and accountable and trustworthy and all of those things. And so they were willing, they said, yeah, come on, you can come and have a look at our arguments. Come and quite ask us. Come and talk to us about how all this is working, because we really want to be accountable. But most companies, I think they're not sure how it's working, and they don't want to open the black box. But I reckon they're going to have to. You know, I don't think in the end we should accept that this is inevitable. And I think there has to be a politics around transparency, accountability, what the limits of... We don't know what the limits of that are at the moment. We don't know how far it will or won't be pushed.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, even if we do move in that direction, if you think of the transparency principles that were applied to sort of government spending and things, we had some very enthusiastic scrutiny of particular kinds of things, particular kinds of spending. But to be honest, people are not people get sort of getting carried away with this new ability for a while, and then everyone forgets about it. It's just business as usual. These things, we're not trained for operating in a scrutable, accountable, transparent, open society in that sense.
So I realise we're running out of time. I'll just run through those and then we can... This is just a summary. I do know that I haven't articulated this brilliantly, but this is the take-home messages. And I think the take-home message is that thinking about digital inequality means thinking along a number of different lines, and it depends what the question is that you want to answer. But it means recognising that this idea of the access divide is not over, and it's not going to somehow disappear overnight. It means thinking beyond just giving people the physical access to stuff, and thinking about what people can do with the web. And I think conceptualising the web actually should be on there, but it'll come down later. Thinking beyond demographic variables. So by what I mean by that is that people say, oh, well, older people don't like the web. Or, you know, those young black women in Philadelphia, they don't like the web because they're young and black and women. But it's not because they're young and black and women. It's because of the nature of the lives of the young black women. It's the material circumstances, the material and social. So there's a tendency to these kinds of people don't use the web. It's not the kinds of people, it's the nature of their lives that we need to understand. And then we need to develop a conceptual and theoretical toolkit. So obviously beyond technological determinism, co-constitution in terms of how the social shapes the technical and the technical shapes the social, thinking about intersectionality, and that's also an important point in terms of beyond demographic variables. We need to think about how the intersections of gender, race, age, class, place, welfare systems, economies, you know, how it's at the intersections of all those social relationships that inequalities happen, and technology is part of the mix rather than separately. And the concept of technical capital, I think, is an interesting one in terms of who has the knowledge and the understanding to derive the most from the web and who has the least. Are we thinking here, even thinking about, you know, I don't know, ad blockers, or thinking about the significance of your online behaviour, or what those data might be used for, or who you're telling what online, those kinds of things. Why does this matter for web science? I think it really matters for those reasons. Who is the web for? We have to move beyond this idea of sort of normative, ungendered, unracialized, unclassed human subject, and the web is for this person, this mythical person. You know, actually, the web is not for everyone in the way that that phrase suggests. What does the web do? So the web is not a passive, neutral, technical infrastructure that has no effect on how inequalities operate. It's profoundly implicated now in how inequalities are produced and reproduced. Can the web be pro-human? I put that in there because that used to be Tim's favourite thing. I'm not sure he's said it much lately. He sees the web as fundamentally pro-human. What does that even mean? I don't know what that means. I think once you've de-essentialised this idea of a core human for whom the web is a good thing, then the notion of the web as pro-human becomes a really difficult notion. But, and that's my last point, can we shape the evolution of the web? I think it's really important not to accept any of this as inevitable. I think that's really the stage we're at. I think Cambridge Analytica and the politicisation of the web over the last 5 years, PRISM, GCHQ, Cambridge Analytica, the Facebook experiment, you know, manipulating the timelines, all of this stuff is really, really politicising the web. But whether people care enough in the end to mobilise, whether politicians care enough, what kinds of groups there are, GDPR is a big deal. It is a big deal. Businesses are closing down, online behavioural tracking businesses are closing down because of GDPR. It matters. End of. Sorry, that was a bit incoherent.
Oh, that's brilliant. I think this thing about the change of the world, it's for, what to me has been emerged as quite salutary, is that people are saying, oh, this Facebook, you know, sort of get rid of your Facebook account. And for many people, they can't, because too much of their lives are implicated in this, their families, their professional existence and their contact with, you know, sort of, it. So whatever power is, you know, has existed in these systems, or whatever affordances have been created to make it easy for people to shift, all of a sudden, you know, Facebook owns 2 million people. And as many people have pointed out, Mark Zuckerberg hasn't stopped apologising about Facebook since, you know, he was hauled up in front of the deans at Harvard. You know, and he just uses the same script all the time about how this is, all this is playing. Anyway, I think, you know, what do you do if you have to go to a women's refuge? What do you do if you're, you know, you're in a sort of some kind of relationship? You have to become, you know, sort of invisible from. How does that marry with the fact that you've got to have an online presence to claim benefits or to achieve anything or to keep in contact with your family? Anyway, I think
that's fair enough. Quite a friend of mine did an experiment last year. She deleted her account and found herself not invited anymore to any events, parties, not even knowing about events that mattered to her in the art world, etc. So there's professional interest there. Such a critical mass. It's a bit like saying, no, I don't have a mobile phone. No, you're expected to have one. You're expected to be available to leave an emergency number with the department, etc. So it's difficult to say, I don't want to be part of this.
I don't use Facebook. I've never had a Facebook account.
I guess.
But I think if you've never had one, that's different from choosing after 10 years not to have one. But I'm taken with, so Farinak again, and she's from the people I talk to the most about this, but she's been very influenced by Donna Haraway's book, Staying in Trouble. And Donna Haraway's argument, and Donna Haraway used to have much more of a kind of sort of utopian alternative perspective on escaping the patriarchy or whatever she would be writing about. Now her perspective is, we can't escape this, we're in it. There is really no way out, and so all we can do is stay with the trouble and try and, you know, try and intervene, try and change it, try and disrupt it, try and do something, because anything else is just a kind of indulgence in a way, a kind of marginal. It's an abdication of responsibility, actually, is what she would say. I think that's quite an interesting position to take.
I also think it depends on your social capital, the level of endowment that you already have when you make that decision. Facebook. Again, I'm reminded of Paul Merton, I've got news for you, and, who said that, you know, I don't have email, I don't have a computer, I don't care about these things, I don't even have a mobile phone. And it's okay for him to say that because he has that certain standing. You know, for anyone who wants to get onto that show, it would probably be quite, you know, stupid not to have a mobile phone. Or, you wouldn't get to that point to make that claim now.
That's
the difference.
I'm sure he has an assistant. I'm sure
who does
that? Whatever that is, you know.
Yeah, they do have all those things. So they won't have. He probably hasn't indirectly rather than directly. So
it sounds nice, but you need to be at that level, you know, to be able to make those sort of things, which is interesting.
I do think it's really important not to forget all that stuff about access and skills.
Yeah.
Because the stuff around algorithmic account, algorithmic discrimination, algorithmic bias and so on, it's kind of appealing, it's new and it's interesting, and all of that's important. But if we want to understand the relationship, if we want to understand digital inequality, whatever that means, or how the web is implicated in inequality, it's quite a complex ask to include all of those things. But I think we absolutely have to include, and how they impact on each other.
I guess we're basically on dependency on issues like fossil fuels and electricity and power and who owns the grid and all these things, and who owns the actual net, the fiber cables, etc., etc. That's
quite
at the end, as far as I
understand. Yeah, there is in sort of resource conflict debates, there is a structure of an argument about resource conflicts in sort of conflict-ridden zones about.